look at episode 82, which actually was the best year of sci-fi as well, 1982.
Explain yourself.
Tron and, Tron and E.T. and Star Trek 2. And so 1982 is wisely and widely touted as the best year for sci-fi fantasy films. It was like the year where all the good...
Tron isn't usually included in lists of all the great science fiction films. Wasn't that an enormous flop? I mean, I like the film, but wasn't it?
It was, but a cult film nonetheless, and a groundbreaking special effects.
Hey, what podcast are people listening to?
Hopefully this one. Welcome to episode 82 of Extra Sequential, comics, pop culture, manga, movies, kind of shenanigans, sugar-coated shenanigans. My name is Chris, and representing BBC Radio Scotland is Maladen Lukerton.
Hello
We're
there.
Very honoured.
Och, mon. How you going? How you going, Chris? How you
it's
been?
It's not good. I can't reach the control panel.
Stop that. How you going?
Scottish and stuff. Good. So what? You're international. Your music
Stylist. Hopefully, yeah. Check out.
This is the man you deserve to know.
Anyone who's been listening to the show probably hears me at the end of every show go, music for the show is at purgeaudit.com. Purge Audit is my music production pseudonym.
There you go.
And recently got a play on BBC Radio 1, a track I did with a UK MC. And for anyone who's into sort of new alternative music getting played on Radio 1, on the BBC Radio, is a huge freaking deal.
Yeah.
So... Yeah. I'm pretty chuffed with that. You know, it's not just me who's saying how amazing I am. Now, all of England agrees.
So I think. And how did you find out about this?
The MC emailed me excitedly. Well, what happened to you this week, Chris? Did you enter into any writing competitions, perhaps?
Yes, I did. I did put in my monologue. As you know, I'm not extremely confident, but hopefully there wasn't too many entries this year, so I might sneak in. But yeah, this is at His Majesty's Theatre, on which I was a finalist last year, which is an enormous honour to be a part of. So yeah, I did one this year, but I kind of struggled this year. But if it doesn't get in, then I'll put it on the blogs for everyone to read. Nevertheless, it's been a fairly disciplined week this week, actually. I've done a fair bit of writing for BrokenFrontier.com, and, it's been good. It's a bit of screenwriting as well, working on a screenplay with a friend of mine. So getting back into the discipline, Maladen.
And eagle-eyed fans of Chris Bather will notice that the man who played... who performed your one-man monologue in last year's finalist entry, yes, is featured prominently in TV commercials for First Home Building Society or something. So whenever I see him, I go, it's Chris.
Blueprint Homes.
See, you know it, Blueprint Homes. See
Blueprint Homes. Well, I know when I first saw the ad, I was like, where do I know that guy from? Oh, yeah, my words were coming out of his mouth. It was pretty awesome.
But
anyway, that's enough backslapping.
We've rambled enough. On this week's show, we're going to be talking about Jim Henson comics. Now, there's been a recent, month or two, there's been a bit... Yeah, Archaea Studios Press, they have got themselves a licensing deal with the Jim Henson Company to do not adaptations of the company's famous works, but new spin-off works and adaptations of long-forgotten scripts and so forth, and we'll be reviewing the latest batch of those, which include, so far it's made of a bit of a splash, A Tale of Sand, and the Dark Crystal prequel, as well as a couple of others we'll mention as well. So that's coming up later in the show. After what we've been reading, Chris, have you read any comics this week?
Yes, I have, actually. I watched a couple of movies as well. I watched I Am Number 4. Based on the teen novel kind of thing, which was okay. And I watched Submarine last night, directed by the guy from the IT Crowd, Richard Iodati. He's got a strange name, but it's kind of set in the 80s in Wales, and kind of one of those indie films that you don't really think much of. But, yeah, it was actually quite funny, you know. And I actually wrote down a quote which made me laugh. The father said, I know you think I'm boring, but once I ripped my vest off in front of a woman... Just the way the actor said it made me laugh. Anyway,
he had to be there.
I did read it. Yeah, he had to be there. But, yeah, it's not a bad film, even though it gets a bit sad and depressing the last half, but the first half is funny. I read Hell Yeah, number one, from Image Comics, written by Joe Keating. I actually met him a couple of years ago when I went to San Diego Comic-Con. He was the former PR guy for Image. And now he's a writer. So he's also writing the very popular Glory relaunch as well, with art by Andre Simanovic and superb colours, Aladdin, by Jason Lewis, basically focused on this teenager called Ben Day. His dad was a Marine who was rescued by the world's first superheroes in the first Gulf War. Ben is going to this school, Kurtzberg, named after Jack Kirby School, for kind of the first generation of super kids. So he has powers, this kid, but he's not extremely powerful. And he's got this weird barcode at the back of his neck, which just appeared during puberty. But yeah, it's actually a pretty good comic. There's like a whole mystery of his parents, what his powers are, and ends on a really good cliffhanger with some kind of colourful manga-ish artwork. So that's called Hell Yeah. It's out now by Image. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. I also read the second issue of Conan by the demo team of Becky Wood and, no, sorry, Becky Wood, Brian Wood and Becky Cloonan. Bit of a gender reversal there. Mm-hmm. But that's pretty good as well. It's basically focuses on a young Conan, and this second issue is basically, well, it's a fight scene above, on board a merchant vessel. But yeah, and it's got a pretty good description of how to shoot arrows as well. So if you're into shooting arrows, by Conan number two. And also, I wrote down this quote: his sword sang a death song. His calm became a sword of madness, a red mist of reasoned anger, a drive to slay all those around him. Exciting stuff, my lad. So that's Conan number two. So, I recommend it, and something we've both been reading, and I think you probably liked it as well, Saga.
Right, the new comic by Brad K. Vaughan and artist
Fiona Staples.
Thank you. He's long, sort of, well, it's been touted for a while, like his big space operatic, you know, yes, sci-fi adventure. So there's been a fair bit of buzz about this, and we got to read an advanced copy. This is the advantage of hosting a world-famous podcast such as Extra Sequential.
Well, we are listened to in more countries than Australia, so I guess that makes us maybe not world-famous, but world-listened to. Yeah, it's actually out on March 14th from Image, and it's a double-sized debut issue. And I think, maybe you can correct me, but I think it's the first time a comic cover has featured breastfeeding.
Oh, I'm sure I could think of one if you push me to it. There's maybe lots of alternative comics which I'm sure have featured that kind of thing on the cover. But for some reason, that was a big fuss for people. But I don't know. Comics
readers, it's controversial.
Prudes. Eh, whatever. But very briefly, to give people a taste, there's a mysterious birth right at the start of the comic. But the child seems to be the illegal result of these two races, I suppose, coupling. And it seems that they're going to be on the run with their baby while being hunted down by various interests. And I'm assuming there's going to be a big, complicated, world that spins out of that. And you can tell it's a bit set up to a much larger story.
It does seem very epic, doesn't it? Yeah. It's got that kind of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
Star-crossed lovers.
Or Romeo Must Die for fans of Jet Li.
That, you know. That was a good film. Yeah, I like that film. And there's like a prophecy thrown in and some older map that they get from a mechanic. And it's kind of interesting the way you set up the world, that it's like sci-fi and fantasy characters and settings all kind of coexisting. So you've got big fantasy creatures, but then you've got sci-fi trappings like fancy guns, and you've got like the bad guys kind of have old TV monitors for their heads. There's a bit of sexiness and nudity in there, but and a bit of swearing. But it's actually a pretty interesting comic. I don't know if I'd get the second issue, to be honest.
Yeah,
I don't know if enough of it grabbed me. It seemed almost a bit too kind of wacky, and if you know what I mean, rather it's almost slipped through his fingers. Like, I think if he just focused on just on the characters, perhaps, and got rid of a bit of the look how awesome and big this world is, look, there's another strange creature. I think if they let go of some of that and kind of streamlined it, that may be more enticing in future issues.
I think this might be one that builds over time more so than like a grabber on the first issue. But well, we'll see what comes of it. But it's an auspicious debut, I suppose. But considering who's been writing it, you know, you expect a certain thing, and I'm sure, you know, Brian K. Vaughan delivers from what his fans expect, really.
Ex Machina and Why the Last Man, is that him as well?
I think so. Yeah, that's him. Yeah.
So he's kind of used to building those kind of layered epics, I guess, isn't he? He's an old hand at that.
That's right. This week I read something that could be anything further from what you read. I read the comic adaptation of He Died with a Falafel in His Hand
Yes, the actor of that, Noah Taylor. Noah Taylor.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the guy who played the dad in Submarine.
Okay.
Continue.
It all comes together. It's a tapestry. It's a tapestry. It's an adaptation of the novel by Australian author John Burnham, which follows his misadventures in the life of share housing in Brisbane in the early 90s, and the comic adaptations by Ryan Vella, whose work I'm not familiar with, but he's got a very just a grungy alt comics look to his style. I don't think I'd be a fan of this film either. It's just a string of random things that happen, and it makes me never want to be in a share house in Brisbane.
It's, you've got a woman.
Some horrific, horrible things happen in this comic, and I hear the sequel is just more of the same, so it tells me maybe he didn't have that much to say all along. In other news of me watching and reading things, I saw Rocky Balboa, the last Rocky film, supposedly.
I'm a big fan of Stallone. Yes, yeah, but he's going to do another Rambo, and there's a spoiler alert, he's just given an interview that Rambo possibly may die.
Okay.
And that'll be the end of Rambo, but Rocky will live on. So, but yeah, I really liked Rocky Balboa because, yeah, Rocky V came out in 1990, 91, something like that, wasn't a great curtain call for the character. But
see, I like Rocky V. I mean, I know a lot of people hate on it, but I liked it a lot more than Rocky IV and Rocky III, that's for sure.
It was different from the formula that the first four set up, I guess, wasn't it?
He was training.
I don't think he actually got in a boxing ring, did he? The only
he never once stepped in the ring. Yeah, he was training a protege, but one fell.
Tommy Gunn.
It's like these six films form the life story of this boxer. It's like Raging Bull. Expanded over six films. It even ends in a similar way. Doesn't Robert De Niro open a restaurant at the end of Raging Bull? Something like that. But it's a nice fitting ending, especially if you liked the first two Rocky films. This one definitely plays on all the positive nostalgia from those films, except for Mickey. He's not really referenced in this film, although he's in Rocky V a lot, so.
He's the trainer, right?
Yeah, he's the grumpy old trainer, you bum.
Well, he did die, didn't he, in Rocky IV? I think he died. Yeah, he died in Rocky IV. And, Club of Lang.
Does Dolph Lundgren punch him in the face? What?
No, it's Mr. T. Yeah, Mr. T pushed him down some stairs and he had a heart attack.
I need to see this film again.
Rocky III. Yeah, Rocky III, which is also the Hulk Hogan's film debut. See, this franchise has got so many auspicious moments.
Okay, let's move on, all right?
Okay, Mladen, kicking off some sad news. Ralph McQuarrie has died. He's the concept artist that a lot of kind of Star Wars fans will be familiar with. He's the guy who basically created the look of, the Star Wars vehicles, Darth Vader, the characters. He was with the original trilogy we're talking about. He also did the original Battlestar Galactica TV series, did Close Encounters of the Third Kind, he did E.T. He passed away recently at the age of 82. He did win an Oscar for Cocoon, oddly enough.
Oh, I like that. After
listing all those films, Cocoon, which you don't think of it being a big sci-fi kind of epic, but... he also did Star Trek IV, and his last film was Jurassic Park in 1993. George Lucas actually asked him to come out of retirement to do the concept art for the prequel trilogy, but Ralph McQuarrie basically said he'd run out of steam and suddenly the new guys have a shot. So, his designs have certainly lasted, you think of the original Star Wars.
It's just a shame that he's not the household name that the little chubby troll George Lucas is. So, it's sad that it takes someone dying for people sometimes to notice, that's the name of that guy who's responsible for everything I loved in this film. You know what I mean?
Well, I think all the hardcore fans and people like you and I, we know who he is. I guess it's just the general populace don't. But, Star Wars fans and I certainly know who he is. I did want to mention a few internet-related news. There is actually if you go to shiftylook.com, there's actually free webcomics now done by, I think, Udon, who do the Street Fighter comics. They're actually webcomics, and this is probably up your alley, based on old Namco and Bandai video games. So they're new, so they basically just bought, Udon bought the franchise of all these video games that nobody kind of remembers, and it's kind of relaunching them in the kind of new manga style. So they're up now as free webcomics, shiftylook.com. The current ones, there's four, such as Sky Kid and Bravo Man. They don't sound familiar to me, so I don't know what era they're from.
Joust? No. Is there an adaptation of Joust? That's the one where you're on back of ostriches, and you... No, never mind. Fans of the video game will know what I'm talking about. What else?
Comixology, one of the, well, probably, I guess, the premier digital comics download application website type thing. They've announced this week that customers have officially downloaded over 50 million comics and graphic novels to date. Yeah, which is pretty impressive. So 5 million of those 50 million downloads came in December. So those downloads include both paid and free downloads. So 50 downloads in, well, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. So, yeah, that's pretty impressive. So, and I guess it's only going to increase.
That's great news. I want these platforms to survive.
And there's a few digital comics apps for Comixology, certainly the premier one. DC Comics have relaunched their website. It's not that great.
Oh, come on. Yeah, you complain about everything that if DC does anything, you complain.
They hurt me, Malad. They hurt me.
They've changed something. I don't like that they've changed something.
I like change, especially when I'm
getting
the bus.
They changed the logo and the website. You
talked right over my joke. Unbelievable. So DC Comics and Vertigo and all the associated sites have now relaunched. I did want to give a shout out to, or thank you to Mark, one of our listeners. He actually mentioned to me, as seen on Hugh Jackman's Google Plus page, this is kind of flying under the radar, surprisingly. This is quoting Mr. Jackman himself, fellow Australian. Wolverine is back on the big screen, July 23, 2013. So, that's
quick.
So next year, a year and a half away, or less than that. So that's the one that's going to be set in Japan. I think Darren Aronofsky was going to direct it at one stage, but now he's directing a film about Noir, I believe, so I'm much more curious to see that. Yeah. So,
I'm guessing he rented X-Men Origins Wolverine, the beginning of Wolverine Origins, and then decided, no, this project's not for me. He could direct Will.i.am's X-Men Origins, Will.i.am.
It was on Top Gear recently. and what else did you want to mention?
It's a piece of DC news. David Mazzucchelli, artist for I'll remember later, and then I'll kick myself for getting
City
it.
Of Glass.
City of Glass, thank you. I was like, City and the City is a book by China Miéville, and I'm thinking of a book by...
I actually just read up about him because I was writing an article on Dial H for Hero for Broken Frontier, and he's doing the relaunch of that.
And what I was trying to think of was his adaptation of Paul Astor's City of Glass. But he obviously was the artist on Batman Year One with Frank Miller. The new edition of that book has come out, and Mazzucchelli's gone on record saying DC just sent him the book last week, and he's quoted as saying, "I really hope people don't buy it." Several years ago, DC asked me if I'd help put together a deluxe edition of Batman Year One. Now whoever's in charge has thrown all that work in the garbage, the design work, and he suggests that anyone who's already paid for this should send it back and back to DC and demand a refund. And the quick list of the changes: they redesigned his cover to look more and recolored it to look more like their DVD animated version of it. They printed the book on shiny paper, which was from the very beginning they wanted it on that matte pulp paper because it's colored a certain way, and he said they printed the color from corrupted out of focus digital files. So he's pretty unhappy with it. It's a shame when when people do things against the artist's vision, I guess, in a certain way.
It is, and there seems to be a lot of politics at DC, and also just kind of changes of staffing changes and stuff. So this would be a time-consuming project, so I can understand, Recently with DC, they also just reprinted their Absolute edition of Kingdom Come, and there was a page without any text in the speech balloon, so DC have had to reprint them all and send them back to retailers. So I don't know what people are drinking over at DC.
Yeah, you I've got a few books like that where on the first read, I'm like, oh, this is experimental, a silent page. No one's saying anything. But, yeah, what else you got?
And I did want to mention there's a couple of other Perth Comics podcasts that have come to my attention
the
last couple of weeks. So who authorised this? So people got to give a shout-out to them because, yeah, they're both relatively new. Been done about 12 episodes each, and we both listened to them this week. So, yeah, it's pretty good. So it's always good to see the community growing. So the first one is Panel 2 Panel, as in the number 2. We'll put links up on the website as well. And the other one is How I Got My Boyfriend to Read Comics. And both of those have something that you and I don't have.
Is it sexy charms?
Well, there could be. A woman. They both have females. So there's a guy and a girl podcast, whereas we are just, you know,
we're just
a sausage fest.
A room full of testosterone is what we are. Never
oh, we
ever
are.
A more
Ooh,
manly
so much when you and I get together.
Manliest podcast on the internet. So let's talk about the Dark Crystal. Chris, Jim Henson, what's the first thought that comes into your mind?
Well, I guess the obvious ones is he's a puppeteer pioneer. That sounds like a rap. I'm a puppeteer pioneer. Put string, me in your ear.
Stringing up MCs like...
Marionette.
Yes.
So, obviously, he's done, you know, Sesame Street, Fraggle Rock. I remember Fraggle Rock growing up. Down to Fraggle Rock. Doo-doo. Turn your cares away. I think the lyrics were something like boo-ba-doo. I can't remember. I've seen very few Muppet movies, and I haven't seen the latest one. But, yes, he's done, you know, Dark Crystal Labyrinth, which I have on DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Big fans of those two films. And, yes, he died in 1990. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, he's kind of left his legacy, and his kids have basically, I think his son and his daughter have taken over from the Jim Henson Company, and the company itself is still obviously quite active. So Arkaya, as you mentioned, they signed a deal with the Jim Henson Company in 2009 and have kind of been producing books based on his properties he created or co-created over the last decades. But yeah, especially, the last year or so have seen quite an influx of Henson-related material from the fine people at Arkaya.
It's interesting they're trying to bring it back, and I guess it's because the people who will enjoy the Henson nostalgia are at the age now where they've got kids of their own and when they're probably wanting to sit down with their kids and, you know, and pop in, you know, the Muppets Take Manhattan or something, you know, and I guess that's why they're licensing the works again now. I mean, Jim Henson, anyone under maybe 23 or 22, probably doesn't mean too much to them, but, I guess, I'm right on that cusp of that age where I started noticing his films, and then he died. So there you go. But,
yeah.
I mean, Dark Crystal was one of those films that I wore my VHS copy out as a kid. And I seem to remember he also did some of the puppet work on the first Ninja Turtles film, if you recall that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, which they're actually doing, I think, a new film, Ninja Turtles film coming out. Yes, you're right.
Mm.
The first film in 1990.
Yeah. Also, a whole bunch of I've seen clips of him appearing on, you know, the old Johnny Carson, you know, late night show, and back when he was just an experimental puppeteer, and his standard characters like Kermit and so forth hadn't been developed, so it was just a nameless frog that looked a little bit like Kermit but little bit weird.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to see those proto things, but. Today, we are talking about the comics, which are being sort of spun off of his work, and I guess they're trying to capture the spirit of them or, you know, just trying to play on that nostalgia and get that, you know, that purchase power of a familiar title, which we all understand. And if it's done well, it's not, I don't consider that a problem. And I guess that's why Jim Henson Company waited to get a publisher who had shared the passion, I guess, which would be Arkaya Studio Press. You and I have read a few of their books before. There's the one about the flood, and now I can't remember what it's called. But they sort of specialize in more indie books, I suppose. They've got a fantasy focus anyway, so they're a good fit, yeah. I suppose. But
they're actually a pretty good good publisher. They do a lot of European stuff as well. And, they don't do monthly comics as such, but rather original graphic novels. So one stories or volumes thereof. And, it's pretty diverse. So, I like that. I'm starting to notice their stuff more and more. So it's good. What one should we kick off with, Mladen?
Okay, well, since we're talking about nostalgia, I guess we can talk about a couple of the nostalgic titles and then move on to the one which was the long-awaited one towards the end. So I guess we could open with Jim Henson's Storyteller. This is a TV show I do remember. I don't know if you...
Okay, because I don't, vaguely. I remember there was a Steven Spielberg one, Steven Spielberg's Amazing Stories, which is, I guess, I don't know. Do you remember that? It's kind of similar. It's like an anthology TV series, which I don't do anymore, do they, really?
Yeah,
like
at that time, there was...
whole families could watch.
There was a lot of that, like, you had the Tales from the Crypt TV show, where you'd have guest directors like Steven Spielberg and Arnold Schwarzenegger, I believe, directed an episode of that. But, that the anthology TV show kind of went out of fashion for some reason. But the Storyteller, I remember not especially liking it either. It always looked great, but the characters were always pretty thin, and I guess over, a 25-minute show, that's 30 minutes minus commercials, you didn't get too invested. It was just like, wow, look at the puppets. And it was like a testing ground for ideas that Henson Studios would then use for their feature films, and that's what it felt like to me. But just to give people an idea of the show, the stories were all adaptations of fairy tales from around the world, often from Europe, I guess. A lot of not-so-familiar fairy tales, I guess. And then you'd have the central storyteller character connecting them, like the Crypt Keeper.
John Hurt.
Ah, played by John Hurt, yes, who had an alien burst out of him in the first Alien, I recall.
You recall correctly, and he was also in Hellboy. And he died in that as well. Poor guy.
What a shame. So this book uses that recognizable label, I guess almost for an anthology title. So it's kind of free reign to just do adaptations of fairy tales, really. The connection to Jim Henson's almost tenuous, except I guess in the visual approach or the injection of whimsy and humor, I suppose. But what do you think of this book?
Yeah, it's actually, it wasn't too bad. I mean, I think there's a fair bit of visual diversity and some pretty impressive names. It's a 120-page graphic novel. Interestingly enough, there was two seasons on the TV, and it was developed by Anthony Minghella.
Don't know who that is.
Of The English Patient.
No.
The English Patient.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I thought you said something weird. Don't worry.
I just watched the Seinfeld episode where Elaine went to watch The English Patient and she didn't like it. Everybody else loved it anyway. This original graphic novel has 9 stories with some pretty impressive. So we've got Roger Langridge, who did the Muppet Show comic for Boom, as well as Thor for Marvel. We've got Marjorie Liu, novelist. You've got Grant Mars, who did Green Lantern, Silver Surfer. Chris Eliopoulos, who did the Franklin Richards kind of all ages. You've got Janet Leigh, Return of the Dapper Men. And you've got Minghella adapting one of his TV scripts from the original late 80s series that was never done. So there's quite a few stories in here. The Anthony Minghella one is the longest one, and that's the last one. And then you've got, stories based on known fairy tales like Jack and the Beanstalk, Puss in Boots, kind of variations thereof. You've got an interesting one called Frog and the Emperor, I think, which is based on an old Chinese fairy tale where a baby is born as a frog to a young couple, and that basically just saves the empire from invasion and all manner of things happen. But I liked the first one, which was by Roger Langridge, and it basically tells this merchant in this kind of medieval town called Krusty Bob, but he's not very good at being a merchant. No one's buying what he's selling, so he signs a deal with the devil. He's not the devil. Well, he doesn't say, "Hi, I'm the devil," but he calls himself Old Nick.
He's a devil. There you go.
He's a devil, let's go with that. He signs a deal with the devil, to sign his wares, and then Krusty Bob becomes so fancy that he starts calling himself Fancy Bob. The devil kind of, in the agreement, the fine print is you just can't let your bag go empty. You always have to have one thing left in there. But then Fancy Bob hires a new assistant, and guess what happens? Each story is kind of like that. It's got kind of those, I guess, like Aesop's Fables, they're all kind of short stories, less than a dozen pages or so, and they've kind of got a little bit of a lesson, I guess, in each of them. But yeah, it wasn't bad. Something I guess you could probably read to older kids, or they could read themselves. But they're all short enough with good pacing that's not boring.
Yeah, it's a dip-in book, really. I mean, and like most anthologies, you get a mixed bag. I mean, I really enjoyed the Puss in Boots, for some reason I said that, Puss in Boots adaptation by Marjorie Liu and Jennifer L. Meyer, and I thought that was beautifully illustrated, and that, for me, was kind of well worth the price of admission. Also enjoyed the Milkmaid story by Colleen Coover.
Colleen Coover, yeah.
That was a lot of fun, where the milkmaid's just telling her friend all the awesome stuff she's going to do. And then it all goes horribly wrong. And that was kind of an interesting one, because that was a story within a story. There's a few of that kind of meta thing happening here. But, in terms of anthologies, it's enjoyable to see some names which maybe aren't top names, but are definitely recognizable in terms of the work they've been doing recently in all ages books. So let's move on to the Dark Crystal creation myths.
Sure. So this is a prequel. You, I guess, would have been fairly young as well, so you wouldn't have seen the Dark Crystal film when that first came out in, like, 1982. I would have been six, so you probably wouldn't have even been born.
I was a negative.
You would have been
-4.
4 years. I'm going to love this movie. So when did you first see it? What do you remember about it?
We would have seen it on TV, and back then... See, kids of the DVD age don't get to do this, but you would record things if they came on TV on your VHS player. VHS is like a DVD except square-shaped, okay? And you can record onto it. And, and if you watch a scene too many times, it gets worn out. And our copy of The Dark Crystal was well worn out. And I remember every time I tried watching it, the VHS wouldn't quite rewind to the beginning. And one time I was insistent and kept rewinding it. And I was like, oh, my God, stuff happens before he plays his flute in the forest. And it was like I'd uncovered this whole bit of the movie I had no idea existed, which is a strange experience.
It's like a deleted scene.
But by far, I think it's one of the best fantasy films of any film, really. And it's probably
totally agree.
Yeah, it's easily my favorite Henson film. Compared to a lot of others, it has a coherent, you know, plot in terms of there's a goal, and a lot of his other films are just random things happening, like The Labyrinth, which I don't personally like at all, is just really an excuse to just have a bunch of random things happen. Whereas Dark Crystal is a bit more directed, I suppose, in what's happening.
And Dark Crystal also came out in that magical year of 1982.
I was so scared. Oh, the Gar theme, they scared the hell out of me as a kid. They're the big crab things.
Yeah, they were kind of like, yeah, what also scared me was in the, I think, The Return to Oz, which is like the Wizard of Oz sequel they did years later, decades later, with the monkeys with wheels for hands. Those things freaked me out.
I watched that recently, and they're just like really unthreatening Cirque du Soleil performers.
There's a French midget under there.
Oh, God. But, the film was, I still think it's still completely stunning and imaginative. It's a bit like Nausicaa in the Valley of the Wind, if you're fans of Miyazaki films, Studio Ghibli, that kind of thing. But this book tells a series of shorter stories, which are prequel-ish, and like the, origins of certain things in The Dark Crystal, which at first I thought was kind of weird. And then I realized, okay, they will be pursuing one storyline over the others. But I didn't particularly ever wonder as a kid, oh, I wonder what Augra was like when she was young.
No, I know what you mean. But I've read a lot of kind of this is how the universe began tales in Marvel and DC comics over the years. But this is far the best one, I'd say. And visually, it's very painterly. It's got a great kind of toned flavor with great colouring, and the caption boxes are very kind of flowing and not your kind of usual rectangular kind of stuff. We should mention, I guess, it's written by Brian Holguin and Brian Froud. Brian Froud was the original concept designer of the Dark Crystal film, and he also did Labyrinth as well. So, and it's illustrated by Alex Schickman, Lizzie John, and Brian Froud. Mm. And there's like a couple of pages of Froud's original sketches in the back. And I didn't realise this as well, but apparently Froud worked on the 1989 anime version of Little Nemo in Slumberland. I had no idea such a thing existed.
Yeah, that's a little scene film. I've never been able to get through the whole thing.
Okay.
It's not really anything like the comic it's based on, but it on its own, it's a pretty watchable film. No, it's Japanese, isn't it? Miyazaki did have some involvement with that film, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, it's Japanese. But yeah, apparently it's a bit of a flop. But I did want to mention that Arkane are also releasing a Labyrinth graphic novel, which again is a prequel focusing on David Bowie's Goblin King character, based on the 1986 film. And yeah,
dance,
Brian Brown
magic dance
is going to be involved in that as well. But yeah, I actually liked this book. Even the art kind of feels like, especially the first chapter when it talks about how the universe began and the crystals and all this, it's kind of like brimming with power, and it's almost like the panels and the pages are crammed with stuff that's happening in a good way. And it's actually on the New York Times bestseller list for 2 weeks.
Oh, good.
Once it came out last year. But yeah, basically the first chapter talks about Orgro, who's kind of the old haggardy, kind of a more...
She's like the seer, the sage. There you go. She's the wise old wizard, except she's a witch.
Yes. Yeah. It's kind of like a female swamp thing when she first is born, and she's kind of communing with nature and naming all the plants and animals and stuff. And then, yeah, she kind of communes with the Gelflings. And, there's a couple of prose pages here as well. One is a poem, epic poem by Thelen the Elder. And there's another prose, but I kind of skipped through those, to be honest.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it kind of talks about her son, Raonic, who looks like a bit of mischief. And this is the first of a trilogy, so Raonic is going to get up to all kinds of craziness in the next volume or two, I would suggest. They don't really explain how Orgra had him, but they kind of hint there must have been some kind of drunk. She's not an attractive woman, so must have been a sorry, Orgra. But, yeah, and then these kind of Lightbringers visit from another world and build this kind of huge crystal fortress, and they teach the Gelflings how to, you know, things like architecture and culture, teach them how to kind of tame the terrain and build things like ships and whatnot.
I guess things we already knew from the film. Seeing them on the page, like, for me was a little bit, I've kind of figured it would have been something like this, but it takes a bit of the magic out of it a little bit.
That's a prequel curse. It's kind of evident. I mean, yeah, Dark Crystal was the first film, and I can't think of any other that doesn't have any humans in it. So, yeah, that was the first film that had all puppet characters, no humans at all. So that was kind of interesting. So if it's kind of an epic film, they could tell that there was a lot of backstory there. So there's a bit of foreboding, and there's quite, especially in the last couple of chapters in this volume, you can tell that danger is on its way in the next two volumes that'll show up. Also included here is the last year's Free Comic Book Day issue as well, which kind of recaps all the other chapters before. It doesn't really offer anything new, just says it in a new way. But yeah, I kind of enjoyed this book. It's kind of epic. It's quite a dark fantasy world. It looks fantastic. It's a 96-page hardcover book. It's called Jim Henson's The Dark Crystal Creation Myths of Volume 1. $20 available now.
And it's anything not all Orgra. My favourite story in this one is a shorter one about just a random Gelfling, and it's called Song of the Tides, and it's the one where he just sails into the deep ocean trying to find a song, and it's definitely the most visually it's the furthest departure from the Dark Crystal, and I kind of like when a prequel just doesn't use the same kind of characters and concepts from the original film, because doing that makes the world seem like a smaller place, like, oh, people keep running into the same people. There's Orgra again,
true.
You know. Whereas seeing a new character do something different in a location we haven't seen but still looks like it belongs in that world, I thought, oh, that's a nice facet to this world. There's also a manga adaptation, like a sequel prequel to The Dark Crystal. And I've only flicked through that, but I remember the Garthim and the Gelflings feature prominently in that. I can't comment as to its quality, though.
You can only comment that it exists.
It exists, and if you're into Dark Crystal, look up Creation Myths and this manga version. I'll find some details, put on the Facebook. The last book we wanted to, I guess we can mention briefly, IKEA have also put out a
Down to Fraggle Rock.
Fraggle Rock trade paperback collecting some of the stories from the 90s, I think. I know Fraggle Rock was the Henson Company's attempt to make world peace. I remember reading that.
Really? It debuted in 1985. I do remember it. And, yeah, basically just kind of these Fraggle creatures kind of lived underground, and they had a big, like, creatures that were smaller than them. They were, like, little miners, and they basically just get into adventures and sing songs and dance and whatnot. But, yeah, this is a 96-page soft cover, so it's only $10, and it reprints the first issue of the original 80 series that came out. So it's been recolored, so it actually has four different stories in it that have been kind of remastered and recolored, but it's kind of very 80s, I guess, and it's, but I guess it's timeless. I mean, it's based on an 80s cartoon. But yeah, I read the first one where Red, who is like the girl Fraggle, is there more than one girl? I don't know. But she jumps ropes. She's skipping ropes, and she jumps ropes too fast, and all the other Fraggles are getting ignored. So this one guy, Gobbo, borrows a metronome from the guy whose house they kind of live under. But the metronome echoes through the whole cave and pretty much annoys everyone. So I don't know. I mean, they did actually do original tales. Two original graphic novels of Fraggle Rock tales came out late last year. Okay. So basically new adventures to kind of reintroduce the characters, whereas this version, Fraggle Rock Classics Volume 1, More to Come, is basically just reprints but recolored. So I don't know. I think I'd probably very loosely remember Fraggle Rock as a kid, but I think probably the new adventures would probably mean more, because I guess they were kind of done in a more, and I was trying to remember, because it doesn't really introduce you until the characters, until the last few pages instead of at the front. So I was trying to remember, what are the Fraggles? What is their purpose in life? What powers do they have? You know, so I was trying to remember that, but whereas obviously they were printed at the time where the TV series was still on the air, so they didn't have to reintroduce characters, whereas now it's 20 years later, just a brief one-page introduction or something would have been nice. But, yeah, you know, give this to your kids. There's no violence or anything in it.
Yeah.
There's no blood exploding. And it's written by Stan Kay, illustrated by Mary Severin.
Yeah, just a cheerful kind of comic, I suppose. That was my impression of it.
Give it to your kids. Yeah.
And I just thought I'd mention that the manga I was trying to remember is called Legends of the Dark Crystal, and it is a prequel, except it has Skeksis in it, which Creation Myths does not. So if you're a Skeksis nut, that's the book for you. But, yeah, that was from Tokyo Pop, who have folded now. Right. So good luck finding a reprint. Hey,
eBay.
Aren't they gone? Yeah, they stopped publishing manga. Tokyo Pop.
Yeah, I said to go on eBay and get it.
Oh, on eBay, yeah. All right, good luck. Let's get on to the main event, because I know when they put out that free Comic Book Day sampler of all the Henson books they were going to put out, and there was lots of them, obviously, there was one that caught my attention. I was excited about it at the time, and, you know, still am now. A Tale of Sand. If the title doesn't seem familiar, that's because this is a unfinished or unproduced screenplay by which Jim Henson co-wrote with his longtime collaborator Jerry Jewell through the late 60s to the early 70s.
Yep.
And I guess the story uses a similar device to the Philip K. Dick story Paycheck, which I guess is the same as the Ben Affleck movie, but where the protagonist is given a random assortment of items at the start of the film. I guess this was meant to be a film, so I can refer to it as a film, which will come in handy in very specific situations later. So it's almost like an adventure game, and things which seem like, why would he have a stop sign in his backpack? And I feel like maybe that's how they approach writing this script. They pick the objects first and then try to write situations around how to use those objects, if that makes sense. Because it is a bit random. This character is, you know, seems to just appear in this wild, crazy New Orleans-style party, and then he's given a map and he's sent on his way into the desert on a quest, which even he's not quite sure what he's doing. And he's being chased by a mysterious adversary. Is that a fair summation?
Yeah, it's kind of, it's very trippy, isn't it? It's not, I think the protagonist doesn't even have a name, does he? He's just an unnamed guy and he's basically confused, and it's kind of almost like he's in a game or whatever, and the townsfolk kind of cheer him on, and he's kind of pushed and, yeah, running throughout the desert, and all manner of weird shenanigans kind of happen. And he's, I mean, it's not a traditional linear storyteller. It's more imaginative and kind of mind warping and freestyling, free association kind of style. But the art style, well, yeah, written by Raymond Perez, or Raymond K. Perez. So he varies his, he's done a bit of Marvel and Dark Horse stuff. But yeah, he was. His name I wasn't familiar with really until I started with this. And I should point out I chose this in our best of episode last year as my best original graphic novel. So that's how much I loved it. But yeah, you're right. The story, it lacks a lot in the story, but nevertheless, you can't help but be drawn into it because it's so lush and verdant, like AstroTurf. I mean, at times it kind of draws like a very Tim Sale painterly kind of style, and then sometimes he's more angular and cartoony like a Stuart Immonen. But his sense of visual restraint, I thought, was quite remarkable because there's a lot of different stuff in here. There's like overlapping panels. There's like he incorporates the original screenplay as a background in some of the pages, but it's never comes across as kind of busy or self-indulgent. Like your eye follows each page quite well. He's not trying to cram too much in.
It is really well. Yeah, it's amazingly well told in terms of comic book storytelling devices, which in adaptations or prequels or sequels or, you know, whatever of potential films or existing films, that seems to be the one thing that's lacking. Whereas this, there's a lot of attention paid to, okay, well, let's make sure this works as a comic. And there's various tricks involved, including using, you know, original pages of script, you know, with typewritten script of, you know, Jim Henson's notes and so forth as, like, backgrounds, like, blurred. So you just get a texture of things. And credits, I should mention, to the colorist Ian Herring, who does a top-notch job here. And there's a lot of high-concept coloring. There's a really... really spectacular sequence where he's just being shot at from a distance. And when he's in danger, it's obviously all red, but when he dives behind a safe area, the color around him goes to subdued where it's still red in the danger. So you get the sense if he put his head into that red area, he'd get shot at. It was just a really subtle thing you only see in comics, but straight away you get, you know, the sense of space of, okay, this is where he's safe. This, and it definitely helps build the tension and the feeling of how you're meant to read this comic. And if you want to see what it looks like, go to the Extra Sequential Facebook site. I think I made a page of the day of one of the two-page spreads. You can get a sense of some of the crazy visual things going on here. And it never gets out of hand in visuals. I just thought it was effective all the way through, which is nice to see.
And there's no captions really, and there's very little dialogue. Mainly the beginning and the end. So I don't know how this screenplay would have got made because it's almost like a silent film. But yeah, there's like a tank and then there's a lion. There's like he's running through a film set and then he approaches the Wild West, the Civil War. There's like a 50s gridiron game. There's like an Arabian Night sequence for a few pages. And then he keeps kind of running and he gets captured and he faces death and he escapes. And so it's kind of... there's a lot of different, it's kind of like those Animalia books. I don't know if you remember them, where like there'd be all different random objects.
But they didn't have a plot, did they? That was just
everything. No, it was just.
Yeah. And this has, has the same thing. It's almost like something Terry Gilliam would do, or it's very true. Baron Munchausen, or The Labyrinth is like this a bit as well, except, you know, just random crazy things happening because they would be fun to see in a film, and they would be, you know, fun to see in a film. But, The one problem I had with this comic, and I guess which made it difficult for me to really get into it, is the protagonist is extremely passive.
Good point. He doesn't really confront anyone, or
he doesn't have a goal. He doesn't know where he's going or why. He's just going along because he's being chased. And I guess that's like, I know they intentionally were doing it like an existential film. That was that, you know, most people don't have a purpose in life. They just keep moving because, you know, whatever. And, you know, Henson does tend to layer those things into his plot, so that's not too outlandish. But it does make it really hard to invest in what happens to this character when he doesn't even seem to really care about the outcome. He could just drop the map and drop the stuff and go, eh, whatever.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's like a fever dream, and hearing people's dreams isn't always the most interesting thing.
I did want to mention something I did notice as well, was this book has more introductions and afterwards than I've ever seen in a comic.
Yes.
I think there's like half a dozen or something ridiculous.
Yeah, the CEO of Jim Henson, whatever, needs to put her 2 cents in, and you know, everyone needs to say how happy they are and how great it is, you know.
Yeah, it's kind of I don't think you kind of just need to say it once, like, okay, this is an unproduced screenplay and this is why it wasn't unproduced. But Jim Henson's obviously groundbreaking. He was a pioneer for what he did, so he's obviously going to have fans worldwide who are going to want to pick this up, so it's probably pretty interesting for them. But even, I think, for people that are new to comics, this might be a bit... this is almost like the work of, say, an art student, or even people that are interested in how to tell stories visually, mm-hmm. like how the eye moves across the page. I'm just looking at some of the pages again now, and just even some of the stuff he does with kind of just... you know, 3 or 4 colours is pretty, I'm glad you mentioned the colours, because it's pretty visually stunning, visually arresting. Kind of each page you could just kind of print and whack on your wall as a poster. I hope we see more from Raymond Perez do this kind of style. So, I think we both would probably pick this one as our favourite, I guess. I mean, I did like the Dark Crystal one as well, I guess, because it told more of a story.
Yeah.
So that's probably more satisfying, the storytelling narrative point of view. But, The Tale of Sand is one of those books that you can just leave on your coffee table at home and just flick through random pages from time to time.
Well, I know I'll be following this artist a lot more, because the storytelling ability on show here, and that's not in the script, you know, the how to make those panels and those sequences work, because it's fine to say... in a script, certain things happen. To make that really kind of pop on that page is a special skill. And, yeah, I'd say it's probably the best comic of the bunch, even if I agree with you, Dark Crystal, Creation Myths may have been a better story. So, yeah.
Fair enough. Sounds good to me. Before we go, I did want to mention Free Comic Book Day, which is on May 5 of this year. Arkea have announced that it's actually going to be an anthology hardcover, 48-page hardcover, full colour, which is pretty good. So it contains original material from A Mouse Guard, David Peterson's Mouse Guard, Jim Henson's Labyrinth, Cursed Pirate Girl, Rust, yeah, Cowboy.
Go back to Cursed Pirate Girl. Who's publishing that?
I've already got that, but I think they must be republishing it or something.
Because that comic, Chris, you could sell that one for quite a bit of money on eBay, I should mention.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. But if they're republishing that, I'm on that shit. Can I say shit? Shit.
You just have twice. That's a 48-page, and I'm pretty sure IKEA did the same thing last year. They kind of printed in a horizontal format, and I think you mentioned they did the Dark Crystal thing, I think, last year. So, this is a full-colour original anthology. So, I mean, we may end up doing a Free Comic Book Day special if we can get our act together again this year before May. But, so keep your eye out for that, because Arkea, they do produce very good-looking books.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know, just I don't mean just graphically, but also presentation-wise. They look good on a bookshelf, you know. Yes, keep your eye out for that. So, there's 4 Jim Henson books right there with more to come from Arkea. More to come from Arkea.
Lovingly produced books. They're not cheap cash-ins. You can tell that everyone involved had... you know, a passion for the project, and they wanted to keep the quality, you know, very to the level of, you know, this material would expect, which is refreshing to see in a world of blue water comics and, you know, other cheap licensed crap.
Can't end the show without getting a dig of blue water, can you?
You know who also sucks? Kevin Smith.
Curses to you.
Okay, let's wrap it up. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another episode of the Extra Sequential Podcast. You can listen to all our previous shows at extrasequential.com. Friend us on the Extra Sequential Facebook site. You can catch more of Chris's writing at comicbookjesus.com, not .blogspot.com, just .com. Yes.
Juice.com and BreakingFrontier.com as well. I've got a fair few reviews, and I just put up an interview actually with Nathan Edmonton, one of my favourite writers, and his new book, Dancer, which is available in May, but it's actually in the current previews, and it looks pretty good. It's set kind of in the world of ballet and hitmen, and it looks pretty good.
Awesome. You can catch my music at purgeaudit.com and my occasional music writings at thefindmag.com.
Yes. If you have any Jim Henson memories, or if you've read any of these books, let us know on Facebook or email us. Thank you for listening as always. We don't know what we're going to be doing next week, but we do know that in the coming weeks we are going to do a giveaway, a prize giveaway. So keep your ears and eyes tuned and or peeled for such an occasion.
Will there be clues, or should I say riddles, scattered around the internet?
It will be riddler-like schemes. I'll be wringing my hands and laughing gleefully with an evil glint in my eye. No, we will give you clues on Facebook, and the first one, as long as you're in Australia, then we will send it to you. Bunch of goodies. This is actually some pretty good stuff. I was just preparing the package, and there's some pretty good stuff in there.
So freaking generous. Too generous?
No, just trying to make room in my bookshelf.
Check for white powder laced inside the prize envelope. Thanks, everyone. You'll hear us yammering on next week. See ya.
Bye now. Have a good week.